of rare, and somewhat to some stations. He was in Seoul, Korea, Dick. And whether or not he, how many wavelengths long, I have no idea. I can't answer that question. Whether he ever did transmit into the beverage, I have no idea. I don't know. Now, what I question, for instance, if I receiving him, if I could have loaded, let's say, the 160, and, I've got the tuner, right? One of the big tuners that can really take a pounding. I have a feeling that maybe at that level, or 21 level,
8 o'clock.
There's a bit of feeding going on in there.
8 o'clock.
Do you believe that if I heard him 5-5 on the dipole, the 160 dipole, that I most likely would be able to transmit to him and he'd receive it, maybe 5-5 on his beverage? I don't know. I really tell you the truth. You know, I wonder, is what you hear the same thing you're going to, in other words, what you're receiving, would it reciprocate to say the same thing would be, in other words, because, you know, it's hard to see, to visualize a beverage, like a beverage antenna. That's most cases very low to the ground. Like I say, I've heard them mostly describe them as 10 feet above ground and gradually then, terminating them on a very gradual angle down to the ground level where they put a couple of resistors once they determine what's the best, you know, ohmic resistor to terminate it at. And I'm wondering, it's hard to believe that antenna is going to perform that well over.
Oh, I think it can. I think it can, Bill. It's worth a try. And McKay Radio and RCA Radio and also AirRink out in the Hamptons, they all transmitted on traveling wave antennas, rhombics and beverages and things like it. Absolutely. They transmitted into the mill. And it can be made to work well. You determine that terminating resistor value such that all the forward going signal gets absorbed. And if you didn't put a terminating resistor, the gain of the antenna would be almost the same. The only problem is the front-to-back ratio would be terrible. Whatever energy doesn't get absorbed by that terminating resistor on the forward end of the beverage reflects back and gives you a pattern in the opposite direction. So your front-to-back ratio will degrade. So you tune that resistor for the highest possible front-to-back ratio. And if you're smart enough to lay out another transmission line that goes out to where the terminating resistor is, and you feed the beverage antenna in the opposite direction, and where you previously were feeding it, you put a terminating resistor, which, by the way, could be in the shack. You now have a beverage that fires in two directions, and you can select which direction. You can have a lot of fun with that. Barry, N2MB, and I have had a number of discussions on this one, and he's almost got enough real estate alongside of his property to do that. That simple little piece of wire across the ground, no one would see it when it drapes across an empty lot that's near his QTH, empty lot or two. And you could probably get an agreement from your neighbors to string a piece of wire across their property, which they would never see, particularly to make it green. So transmitting to a beverage, there's nothing wrong with doing it. Just make sure the terminating resistor has got enough wattage capability and you're home free. It doesn't suddenly explode just because you're transmitting into it. Now, when you are on a VHF frequency and a UHF frequency, the law of reciprocity is 99% true. Whatever pattern and gain and performance you get out of an antenna, when you transmit with it, your receiving performance is the same on VHF frequencies. When you get down to an HF frequency, the antenna itself obeys reciprocity. But remember I said before, let me drop. When you test an antenna, you think you're testing an antenna, you're testing an antenna plus the environment around the antenna. On HF for frequencies, that environment around the antenna includes the ionosphere. The ionosphere does not obey reciprocity. So you can select whatever antenna you've got on your property to receive a guy, and you'd like to believe that if you receive him strongest on antenna A, that when you transmit on antenna A, he's going to get the best signal. That's only going to be true half of the time. The other half of the time, if you choose one of the other antennas, even one that almost doesn't get him at all because of lack of reciprocity of the ionosphere. A signal going from east to west of the ionosphere experiences very different characteristics than a signal going from west to east. So the ionosphere, because of its crazy characteristics in polarization as well as pattern, the way the signal reflects off the ionosphere, east to west is not the same as west to east. So it's got different bounce positions, different bounce polarizations. Everything is different. So roughly 50% of the time is my guess that whatever antenna gives you the strongest transmission on a DX circuit, so like Seoul, Korea, is not going to be the same antenna that does the best receiving. Receiving and transmitting antennas, which one works the best, is going to be an interesting experiment. And I think you should try it. And I bet you you've got the ability to put up a beverage also. No way of knowing how long that beverage was in Korea, but he probably, to be a good DX station in a country like that, he probably was a person reasonably well off economically. And maybe he's got enough property to put up a whole lot of wavelengths of beverage. Back to you for any comments on all of the above, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. A question for you then. You just said that RCA, the K radio, and a number of the other stations that operated, I guess, from the 20s up until what, the 50s or 60s, until they dismantled those stations, were using Beveridge and Rompix. In other words, those antennas were consistently with work. Let's say they had them set up, so I guess those stations, well, they were communication stations that can, to, I assume, link North America with Europe. Now, you're saying to me that if I was to put, I don't know, I'm getting a look here. I got a comment that one more wire, and I better go see a divorce lawyer. Yeah, it's getting up. No, I think I have to hold off on the beverage thing. If they use those type of antennas there at the stations out on the island, tell me, if I was to put up a beverage or had a beverage and it was, say, I don't know, close to the ground, maybe along fence lines or whatever, are you going to say to me that this could be, for instance, in some particular direction, a consistently best antenna of, would it always perform really well, Dick, Beveridge? In other words, I'm trying to visualize why go up umpteen feet into the air if hanging along the ground is going to do quite well, over.
As you lower a beverage closer and closer to the ground, the performance does decrease. But it doesn't decrease super fast. A 10-foot above the ground beverage can give you quite a bit of performance. 20 feet above the ground is going to give you a little more performance. But the whole beverage concept of being a straight piece of wire, multiple wavelengths long, develops a beautiful directivity pattern. View that as gain, capital G, gain. The antenna has got gain. That's why McKay radio, Aerolink radio, and RCA radio use them. And yes, it linked them with South America, Europe, Asia, Australia. It linked them. And they would choose which antenna aimed in which direction, which hour of the day to transmit the data that they were transmitting. They had an awful lot of data they were transmitting back and forth to all those places. Until the undersea cables and the satellites came along, those stations were in full blast operation. In the case of McKay radio, right up until 1985. It was the winter of 1985 when they started taking that apart. I was there, collecting some of the hardware.
Yeah.
So right up until then, they were transmitting 10 kilowatts into those antennas. Up until a couple of months before there. I can remember traveling on the L'Orient Expressway in that vicinity. And because of the tremendous amount of power they're transmitting on HF frequencies, my AM and my FM radio would go crazy as I drove by their QTH in the Brentwood area. Brentwood, Hop Hog area is where they were located. So they were definitely transmitting into those antennas. And Mrs. Schneider is a fairly understanding lady. She's lived with you now for 40 some odd years. If your neighbors were sufficiently compliant with a simple wire being put up as a receiving antenna across their property, if they would go along with it, I think there's ways that you could do that as an experiment now. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, is it? K2KEY. Well, I wouldn't transmit into an antenna. It's only going to be maybe 5-6 feet or whatever above the ground. I wouldn't, you know, going hundreds and hundreds of feet away from the home QTH here. God knows what would be going on down the other end. Kids, dogs, and cats, and everything around. You know, like I just couldn't conceive that. But I understood that they said that if you want to put a beverage, a well-working beverage, put it approximately only high enough that it doesn't strangle somebody as they go by. They basically, most of them, I've talked to a number of people that have used beverage, and they all said, oh, 10 feet is excellent for the performance of the beverage, plus the number of wavelengths. Now, what is the, well, let's say if you wanted to try a beverage, how many wavelengths? Let's take a band like 20 meters, because I guess like you say 160, you need a humongous number of acres. Let's say a band like 20 meters, 14 megahertz. How many wavelengths would constitute somewhat of a, let's say, a working beverage, Dick, over?
Okay, 20 meters, the wavelength is a little bit more than 60 feet, 65 feet. 65 feet is one wavelength. If you could string a few hundred feet of wire, you'd have 3, 4, 5 wavelengths. The gain of the beverage comes from the number of wavelengths of the wire. The efficiency of the beverage is determined by how much the ground along the length of the wire is absorbing the signal. So if you put the beverage 20 feet above the ground versus 10 feet above the ground would absorb less of the signal that's parallel to that wire along, as the signal is traveling down that wire. However, you're one of those lucky guys who lives very close to the seashore. It is my guess that a zillion years ago, that seashore has washed over your property, and you've got highly conductive soil. You've got the ideal environment, Mel. Highly conductive soil. 10 feet above that soil, that beverage is going to sing. 20 feet is going to sing a little bit better. But if you can get permission from your neighbors to string a simple piece of almost invisible wire, it could be relatively small gauge. It could be enameled wire, so it turns almost invisible. Because the extra wavelength of the wire in the beverage manner gives you this beautiful pattern that gives you gain. Even if the antenna only had 35% efficiency, 35% efficiency is 5 dB down in performance. But because it's got 10 dB of gain, I think you see where I'm going here. We come out ahead. It's a very simple antenna, and those major institutions were using them for lots of decades, and we're very happy with them. Transmitting and receiving. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, I guess it's possible. I have to think about this. Seriously. It's fascinating because, like I've said in the past, I have heard people talk about different antennas, and the beverage has come up several times with DX stations, these so-called, you know, professional DXs, and most of them have a lot of property. So I would assume that they most likely have a couple of different beverage antenna setups. The only thing is, of course, it would be limited to receiving, whereas I have not heard them using it as transmitting antennas. What the reason is, I don't know. Or maybe they have used it as a transmitting antenna. But according to you, you said that the stations that were out on the island were using them as both receiving and transmitting antennas. But boy, I would, you know, I sure would be thrown for a loop if I all of a sudden found that something like this, that would outdo a multi-element beam on 20 meters at least 50% of the time or whatever, you know, it throws sort of a monkey wrench into thinking of what the heck you're putting up these towers for if you can do quite well with a piece of wire basically almost strung along the ground, Dick. Over.
Each antenna will have good performance, some portion of the sunspot cycle, some portion of the day, some particular frequency. You can't have enough antennas. I know. So people are going to worry a little bit about what is the aesthetics like. And we amateurs look up in the air and we look for antennas. And we say, boy, that guy's got a lot of them. The majority of the people he knows don't even know the color of the shingles on his house. People look down at the ground, they look straight ahead. They almost never look up in the air. They can have all kinds of wire and steel and antennas and whatever up in the air. And until somebody points it out to them, they don't know that they're unhappy about it. That's just human nature. And yes, sometimes very simple antennas of the Beveridge and rhombic variety can have an awful lot of performance for very little hardware. There's lots of people who have got a couple of acres of trees that by way of a slingshot and a fishing weight, they can string the wire across the trees and make a 500-foot-long... They think they're building an end-fed ZEP antenna, an underground wire antenna. It might simultaneously be a bidirectional Beveridge antenna because they didn't bother putting a terminating resistor at the end. It doesn't stop working. It doesn't go lowering gain. Just if you don't put the terminating resistor on, it's got a 20 from slack ratio. And by remotely controlling that relay, that's putting in that terminating resistor at the end, by feeding voltage, DC voltage down that wire, you can intentionally make the Beveridge antenna fire in both directions or fire in one direction, depending on who you want to talk to when. So it doesn't have to be a high gain antenna in one direction only. You get a little bit more gain if you've got a low loss feed line and you feed it from the other end. But you don't have to. It's a whole other antenna type that is not well understood. There's a medium amount of information on this in the ARL antenna book on Beveridge and other kinds of rhombic and traveling wave antennas. They've got a lot to offer. You'd be amazed, let me drop. You'd be amazed how many microwave antennas use some of these properties. The G-line antenna uses some of these, G-line transmission line uses some of these properties. The polyrod antenna is another kind of leaky wave, multi-wavelength long structure that's got Yagi-like gain. That Beveridge antenna, properly set up, can have a pattern with a little bit more gain than your four-element, or the guy in Korea, his six-element Yagi antenna on 20 meters. The Beveridge is capable of having more gain, even though it's so simple looking. It's so inexpensive to construct. Once you understand the theory, a traveling wave structure, a leaky wave structure, these are the words explaining the phenomenon. As the wire gets longer and longer, the main lobe pattern gets a little more narrow, as long as you're not losing the signal. And because you've got high conductivity soil there on Dover Street, it's rather ideal to run as an experiment, Mel. Boy, you really need some more time to run all these experiments, Mel. K2AEY, K2RIW.
BXL with a comment.
BXL recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
My friend Frank. Okay, very good. Well, you know what you need? You need a lot of time and a lot of aches, then you could have a grand old time with antennas because it seems like there's no end to it, really. Well, you know, it's constantly somebody telling you something, you know, scratch your head, and, you know, until you actually do the thing itself. I love modeling. I've used this program a number of times, the NEC program, and I love modeling it, looking at it and everything, but I'll tell you something, until you go outside and so-called do your antenna range work, I'm sometimes not convinced that all this modeling is really that accurate. So, all right, pick up Frank and then we'll continue on. It's getting late. I don't want to, hold us up because I know Paul wants to get on with the base report, Dick. So go ahead, pick up Frank first. Go ahead, KCJE, by listening.
Go right ahead, Frank.
He built actually an addition onto the house a radio room, and he had towers. He owned, the property is still intact, the house is intact there. It's one of the large properties here in Manhattan Beach. What was his call? This, I think it was a W-2 with an E in it, something like that. But he's gone many years, and he sold the property here some years ago, and moved upstate New York briefly, and then I believe moved down to the Caribbean or whatever and passed away or something down there. I could picture the antenna ray, Dick, over.
Yeah, there was a guy in Brooklyn who had a 2-meter Yagi with something like 38-foot-long boom, rotatable 2-meter Yagi that he used on moon bounce. So there may have been more than one in Brooklyn at the same time, Mel. Go ahead.
In Julio, I think I know, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, he had 4 KLM Yagis. He was in an apartment. Herb Power, W-A-2-W-O-M.
That could have been him. That could have been him. I thought it was a K-2. Was there possibly more than one at one time, Rich? There could have been. I mean, once a guy starts doing successful moonbounds, he acts as a spark plug, and maybe at least one other guy in Brooklyn joined him. Over to you, Rich.
I don't know, Dick. That's the only one I knew. He knew Barry very well. He'd come over to my house once with Barry. Herb, W-A-2-W-O-M. I don't know what happened to Herb. He moved to Florida, and me and Barry have never heard from him again.
Where was Herb living?
Water. rainwater, would you say, is fairly pure in its nature, where it doesn't have a lot of impurities in it, but rainwater by itself should be theoretically just about an extremely high resistance, to try to measure the resistance of water, pure rainwater in, within itself?
I think there's a catch there, Joe. Where did you collect the rainwater? If you were in a desert area like Arizona, and that water comes through that fairly clean air at a high mountain retreat, quite possibly that's very pure water. The water that you and I get coming out of the sky where we live, which is filtering down through whatever pollution is in our air, is that really extremely low in the ionic content? I'm not sure. But it wouldn't take very long to run an experiment to find out. Put out some kind of an extremely clean container, collect some rainwater, put two metal strips in there with your ohmmeter, and you'll know real fast what the conductivity is like. And you can also get a hold of deionized water, which I think is one step beyond distilled. So deionized water can be a nearly perfect insulator, and that is a purchasable item. I've seen some technical articles in the last month by people saying that I'm using deionizing water to clean up this particular object that I'm about to electroplate, and after I do that cleaning process, what am I allowed to do with that deionized water? Deionized water, is it a toxic substance that I'm disposing of? Do I have to go to the expense of disposing a toxic substance? And of course, the big variable in the case was, what are you cleaning? If you're cleaning sulfuric acid off of something, a deionized water is probably considered contaminated. If you're using it to clean off fingerprints on something, probably no problem. And why don't you just recycle the water? So, water is a strange substance. If you really have it pure, you can put a zillion volts across it and it doesn't conduct. The tiniest amount, a couple of grains of salt, will make it conduct like gangbusters. I realized that real fast way back in 1964. I built myself a 2,000 volt power supply for my 4CX 250B transmitter. I finished the power supply first, and I wanted to test it on the full load. And I said, okay, this power supply is good for half or three quarters of an ampere at 2,000 volts. That's 1,000 watts. Where can I get a dummy load resistor of just the right value to load down a 2,000 volt power supply, which I think requires something like a 4,000 or an 8,000 ohm resistor at 1,000 watts? Didn't have anything like that. I said, okay, I'll get a great big ceramic bowl of water, and I'll put two metal bars in the water, put that as a load on the power supply, and pour salt into the water until it has the right number of ohms. That was my intention. I put in the metal strips in the water, and it drew a lot more than three quarters of an ampere. The water coming out of the well on my property in Middle Island already contained enough mineral matter that it was highly conductive. And I didn't have to put any salt in. It was already too conductive. And then I started doing experiments of retracting the metal strips from the water, and I started drawing arcs across the water as it was making steam and making all kinds of colorful displays. And that was another whole science experiment in itself. A fun experiment. You got to be careful, though. I was very close to, if I wasn't careful, I'm very close to conditions that are potentially electrocuting. You got to be very careful with the 2,000 volt power supply. So, water fresh out of a well was way too conductive. I don't think I could have gone out and bought distilled water. Maybe I could have. It didn't occur to me in those days. I think people did use distilled water in their clothes irons. Nowadays, getting deionized water, distilled water, drinking water, whatever, Poland Spring. It'd be fun to take the various bottles of water that are being sold in the supermarket today and measure their conductivity and make some judgment as to what kind of mineral matter it contains. That would be a fun experiment. Who would ever think the day would come along where people would pay five times as much for water as they pay for gasoline? What's wrong with that picture? Wild. Oh, and you, Joe, W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
particular subject of water and conductivity probably has to do more directly with getting a cable contaminated with water, fairly fresh water, without a lot of impurities. So if you looked at it with an ohmmeter, you wouldn't really see a lot of a resistance, something maybe in megohms or something like that. But yet the water in itself would cause the antenna cable to be quite a dummy load or have quite a lot of insertion load point to point. That's probably what I was mostly getting at about the particular subject. As the higher as the water had less and less impurities and became higher and higher throughout the cable, it still had a fairly good load as far as our reference going into it, right?
I think the answer is yes. Now, where I ran into a similar problem is that I own a Wim Hof machine and a Van de Graaff generator. These are both machines capable of generating 200,000 volts and almost 500,000 volts. And I wanted to run an experiment to put a known load across that machine. And the known load would have to be something like a million megohms. Well, you can't go out and buy a million megohm resistor off the shelf. It doesn't exist. And even if it did exist, it wouldn't be made in such a way that it could tolerate half a kilovolt or a quarter of a kilovolt without arcing over internally. It takes a very special design to do that. So I said to myself, okay, I'll take a piece of polyethylene tubing, plastic tubing, clear tubing, and put really pure water in it and make the tubing the right length so it has the right number of ohms from end to end to act as the dummy load to do this high voltage experiment I wanted to do. And I started off with the water coming out of my tap, and of course it was way too conductive. I haven't yet gone out and bought deionized water and repeated that experiment. But to come up with a million megohm or a 10 million megohm resistor that can tolerate half a kilovolt requires some length of tubing to do it, of some amount of conductivity of that fluid, and maybe the right kind of oil, transformer oil or whatever. There is a substance somewhere in this planet I can put in that piece of tubing that will have the right length so it doesn't arc over, the right resistivity so it will have the right number of ohms from end to end so I can do that particular experiment that I want to do. High voltage is really peculiar stuff. You would never think that two particular probes in air with high voltage across them would behave any differently, left to right or right to left. You would never think that voltage is a violation of reciprocity. It does. Depending on the two probes, which one is sharper and which one is duller, which one has the positive voltage and which one has the negative voltage, makes a huge difference. If the sharp-pointed probe is the one with the negative high voltage on it, that one will continuously be making a corona discharge to the air and will never allow you to build up the high voltage in the first place. If you do it the other way around, put the positive voltage on the sharper probe, put the negative voltage on the more blunt probe, the system will allow you to build up an extremely high voltage before it arcs over with a very nice, loud zap as it does it. You'll never get there if you reverse the polarity. So the way two metal objects in free air behave under high voltage is an interesting experiment, and there's some nice physics explaining that. And you can actually make lifting devices with these concepts. You can make a kind of model flying saucer that will levitate itself above your table by using high voltage and the way the air discharge occurs around the sharp points. And there's a name for that effect which I can't think of right now. I know we've gotten off of subject of what you're asking, Joe, but let me turn it back to you so you can get us back on subject. H-U-R-Y-Y, H-U-R-Y-W.
The U.S.
one. I'll recognize, but Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
You know, what I was getting at with the whole, talking about this whole particular subject, and it probably has happened some time to time, you try to tape something up and insulate something really good, whether it's really good, but it's always managed to get some sort of water moisture, water directly into the cable or above the cable, or something like that, or close to the wire connection. First of all, meanwhile, it's just an ohmmeter cost, and eventually, the resistance in a lot of cases, water is very pure. You might see maybe 200K resistance, maybe 500K resistance. You say, ha-ha, I found a bomb. But as the water impurities lessen in the water and the resistance theoretically goes up and up and up, you really wouldn't see that in the case. Of course, an ohmmeter, regular standard ohmmeter, what I have, only does it like 30 meg or so. I mean, I'm just wondering if it's possible to have a resistance across the cable exceeding what you can measure, but still be a problem as far as water is within itself.
John, good question, and you're on to something here, Joe. Water that drifts into our cable by migrating through the connector or as water vapor migrating through the polyethylene outer jacket of a flexible piece of foam-filled cable, that water, by the time it gets into the working mechanism of the cable, usually carries with it contaminants, fingerprints and salts, whatever. The manufacturing process of the connectors, the cable, and so on, it's got all kinds of chemistry, which is ionic. When it's mixed with water, it will become conductive. The chances of you and I getting pure rainwater with no other contaminants inside of our connector so that water is present but it doesn't show up on an ohmmeter, I think that's an extremely rare circumstance. Not impossible, but rare. And if it did occur, what you're onto, and you're right, is that your ohmmeter test may give you a false negative. In other words, your ohmmeter says that the it's more than 30 megohms, everything's hunky-dory, but the presence of the water, which is a bipolar molecule, very similar to that glass of water you put in the microwave oven, or the moisture that's in the food that's in the microwave oven that creates the majority of the heating, the bipolar water molecule is such that the molecule tries to flip back and forth following the polarity of the RF wave of the microwave oven, and it can't keep up. But the hysteresis loss is the loss mechanism that creates the heating. And by the same token, any water in your collage cable is going to create heating, and you should view that as insertion loss. Your piece of cable that normally has 1 dB of loss per 100 feet can easily climb to 20 dB of loss per 100 feet because there's water in it. And beyond that, even if the water only migrated to the outer layers of the foam, of your foam-filled cable, and never got to the center conductor, it is still present across the area where the E-field is going to take place when you're transmitting a signal down that cable, therefore you're still going to experience the loss. Water in any of our cables is an extremely lossy material. You've got to do heroic things to keep out the water, or you're going to suffer insertion loss that you're not going to be happy about. That's the bottom line of all this. Keep out the water. In the case of foam-filled flexible cables, you've got to be very careful with some kind of an outer foil coating underneath the jacket of the cable, because just plain braid is not going to hack it. Any of your foam-filled cables are going to develop a lot of loss. Been there, done that, suffered a disadvantage, and I wish I had known this earlier. Let's see what Paul's got to say. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a point.
Okay, Dick, I'm just going back to the experiments that you do with the positive and negative. If you get any type of pulses in air, what happens to different situations? I'd read about that a long time ago with welding arms. You hook up any kind of equipment for welding. You have reverse polarity. You have straight polarity, you have AC, and it made me wonder in the beginning, what are you doing with all these different, why don't you just stick with one, either reverse polarity, straight polarity, or AC, but there's different purposes for each, and they use that in different applications, and I ran the experiment that I'd read about. Basically, if you're just taking our, let's say, a regular reverse polarity setup for stick off welding, you want to burn up the rod. The idea is to burn up the rod as much as possible to fill in the joint and drop it. I'm a guy, so what you do is you would have the positive terminal in your hand, and the work that you're welding would be the negative terminal. And electrons come flying out of that work and bombard the anode, welding arc that you have in your hand, and that to try to consume that as much as possible to fill it in. Now, the experiment was what would happen if you take two welding sticks? It doesn't matter which size, what size diameter. It could be very heavy, 1/8, 5/32, or 5/16, whatever. But you take two identical rods and hook one up, positive, one negative, and then strike it off between the two. And you would think, okay, most people would think they'd burn down equally and drop it. Doing that experiment, I don't think I dropped it long enough. Doing that experiment, one rod actually burns down more than the other. I mean, it's a big difference. The positive will burn down. You only have like 2 inches left on the positive, maybe about 4 or 5 inches still left on the negative side. Take the same two sticks and hook it up to AC, an AC machine. Let me drop it. It's interesting to look at the two sticks, and I've done them all, playing around, and they're exactly even. If you go down 2 inches on one, it's down 2 inches on the other one, but not so for reverse polarity, which is, one positive and one negative, or actually the other way around. And they know this, and they use this. When you weld something, let's say you're going to weld tungsten and inert welding, you're going to weld something fancy like gold or stainless steel, whatever you're going to use, you usually use a tungsten rod. That's what you're holding in your hand. And you don't want to burn that up. I mean, that's very expensive. You want to keep that. You wish you could keep that forever. So you want to keep the heat away from that, so that they will use straight polarity, and they'll have one hooked up actually in reverse than the normal application to try to keep as much heat away from that and attack the work, heat that up. And of course, in that case, you use a filler rod. So we went through all of that, Dick, and a lot of fun brought back memories when you mentioned the difference of what happens with any kind of arcing and, with the two different wires behaving differently. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Fascinating. That arc that you strike is a plasma. A plasma is the fourth state of matter. The four states are solid, liquid, gas, and plasma. A plasma, by definition, is a conducting, usually three-dimensional medium, a gas-like medium that is conducting. To be conducting, it's got to have positive and negative ions. There's a kind of a plasma inside of a human being. You put your hands across a high-voltage DC power supply. Common sense would lead you to believe that electrons are flowing out of the negative lead of the power supply. Those electrons are flowing down that copper wire. You would think now that the electrons just jump into your hand and flow through your body. Uh-uh. Inside of your body, it isn't electrons that are flowing. It's positive and negative ions. That blood of yours, that's one of the most conductive substances you've got, is a salty solution. That salty solution in fluid contains sodium ions and chlorine ions. Sodium, in other words, the salt that got into your blood, broke up into sodium and chlorine. How much chlorine is there, I'm not sure. But throughout your body, there is sodium and chlorine in some portions. And so the sodium has one polarity, the chlorine has another polarity, and it is those ions that are flowing through your body. That is the current. It's not the pure electrons flowing through your body. These are minor details, but when you get down to the nitty-gritty of what happens and why you get a flood for putting your hands across the high voltage, some of this may help. So, in your case, you've got these positive and negative ions flowing through that plasma of the arc that you've struck. And such, whatever the rod is made out of breaks up into positive and negative charged particles, and the positive and negative charge particles, the positive charge positives are attracted to the negative terminal and vice versa. So it is a big determining factor as to which one of the materials is sacrificial and which one is gathering the material. By the same token, when you put a metal plate on the bottom of your sailboat and you try to protect it from ionic corrosion, there is a given polarity you should put on that plate, and that's ordered to give the most amount of protection to the metallic hardware on that sailboat. You'd rather not have your propeller and shaft and whatever get eaten up. You'd rather have the metal plate on the bottom of the sailboat be the sacrificial thing which you can replace. Because replacing it is easy. Replacing the propeller and the shaft is hard. This is some of what I've sort of gathered on this particular subject. I wonder if it's ever been explained that way, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
This is K2KUI. I got also a question.
Mel, right after Paul. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, in some of the metallurgy books, you know, they will get down to those. You know, they'll get off topic a little bit like that, but I mean, they will concentrate primarily on the welding effects. Many different types of. There's probably as many different types of welding as there are ham radio, so they'll try to, you know, cover as many as possible. But yeah, they'll you know, you can get into the ions and all that, you know, the electrons flying off the stick and hitting the protons, on and on, which is true. You know, I mean, it's really no different than the theory of the cathodes and the anodes. You know, with inside the tubes, you know, the electrons are taking off and moving through space. I mean, it's really happening with an electric arc as well. I heard Mel in there. Good evening, Mel. Back to you, Dick.
Yep. It's got something, a lot to do with the way a thermionic emission takes place inside of a vacuum tube. And the reason why that vacuum is required, because those electrons boiling off that cathode want to go flying at the speed of light if they have the chance to accelerate themselves that fast toward the plate, toward the anode. And if they strike an air molecule in the process, they get slowed down, they light up the air molecule, and you get energy loss. The arc that you strike with a high voltage power supply like my Wimshurst machine or my Vandegraaff generator, the fact that air is good for 30,000 volts per centimeter. And when you go to higher altitude, the air breaks down at a lower voltage. Until you hit a hard vacuum, the higher the altitude, the lower the voltage it creates is required to create a breakdown in air. And at first that seems crazy, because you would think that the air is a beautiful insulator, and there's really more going to it. What causes the avalanche breakdown of air is that if the voltage is high enough, that the average intermolecular distance between the air molecules is such that a free electron is able to get up enough velocity that when it hits that air molecule, it does it strong enough to break up the molecule, the air molecule, in such a way that another electron or two electrons gets boiled off. Now you've begun the avalanche process. The chain reaction has begun. At a lower voltage, the air molecule gets struck by that electron that hasn't been yet accelerated to a high enough velocity, and it basically bounces off of it. Nothing happens, and no discharge occurs. Your spark plug must have a high enough voltage to break down the gas in that cylinder. And one of the things I recognized when I had a car once that had a whole lot of ignition static is as I pressed down in the accelerator, the ignition static got louder. That's because the richer fuel mixture in the cylinders was a better insulator, and it took higher voltage for the spark plug to arc over, and the higher voltage when it finally did arc over made more ignition noise. K2KEY, K2RIW, you got it, Mel.
Okay, give it a chance here to see if anybody else wants to join us. You know, you brought up something about water. Let me tell you, many years ago when the kids were young, we had a vaporizer. Now, this vaporizer, let me describe it. It was like a gallon jug, clear gallon container, glass container. And on top of it was a cover that you filled the container first with water. And you put this cover on, you screwed this cover on. And on the bottom of this cover it was made out of bakelite, had two rods that extended down into the water, and a little chimney that came off the top of it. The wire just went to the tube from the AC. You just plugged it in the wall to the AC, and it vaporized the water. It gave off, you know, because, you know, to keep the room from, in the wintertime, from coming so dry, so the kids didn't have that dry throat and all, and supposedly prevents colds and all. And they said with that, that if it doesn't start vaporizing within, say, 10 minutes, of putting the water in and sticking this thing and plugging it in the wall, they add a pinch of salt. But they also said, specified on it that, of course, that they said when the water boils out, it'll stop automatically, no switches or anything. But they had a marker on the plug, and they said every so often you should reverse the plug. In other words, the little marker, that red marker on the plug, was on the right side. You should, every time you refill it, you know, flip it over now, put the plug so it, the marker is on the left side, Dick. So it shows you. Now, I never had to put salt in, just regular sink water, and this thing used to steam away, over.
I've owned one of those. I've used one of those, and they worked rather well. And you, in theory, you have to clean them periodically because they do build up excess salt. The mineral matter that's in your water tends to get left in the machine. Now, the reversing the plug is a little bit mysterious to me, Mel, because the voltage coming out of your plug in the wall, in your case, comes from Con Ed, and my case comes from what used to be Long Island Lighting Company, now it's LIPA, Long Island Power Authority, is AC. It is reversing 180 degrees on each half cycle. There were places in New York City that in the old days had DC voltage. Pratt Institute was one of them. So if you had DC voltage out of your particular wall, then reversing that polarity of that plug would make a lot of sense. But with AC, I think it's not required. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY? K2LIW?
Questioned the same thing. I saw that in the instructions. It didn't say anything about using this on DC, which would, I guess, be hard to come by. But they specified on it. They marked the plug. They had a marker, a red marker. And I said, what the heck goes on here with AC and reverse it? And they said, to maintain long life of the device, to reverse the plug. Why? I don't know, Dick. I have no idea what exactly that would do, but they must have had some reason, but they didn't tell you, over.
Out of curiosity, do you still own that humidifier with its instruction manual, Mel?
No, I threw it away years ago. What happened? I think the rods did eventually deteriorate. They just disappeared. I think it just went to pot, and I think that, oh yeah, that's right, the bakelite pot cracked into something or whatever. It just be, you know, this is a lot of years ago. I would say that was 30 years ago, so it's gone, Dick, over.
Now, I was told that a certain percentage of New York City at one time had DC voltage. Now, when people would run an Aki-Daki radio, AC-DC radio, you would have to occasionally reverse the plug in the wall so that the radio would come on. I wonder if you've ever lived through any episodes like that. I wonder if you know how much of the five boroughs of New York City really had DC. Was it something only true for the laboratories at Pratt Institute? I suspect in the old days, there was a lot more DC in that city. Back to you, Mel.
Oh, yes, of course. New York City, all the elevators running on DC. You have shops with big motors, you know, that ran these shafts. They had these shafts going. I remember going into this old shop, and they had a lot of machines. Everything was overhead belted. And, you know, you'd flap the belt. You'd use a belt tool. You use that, you know, it was a stick. And you could change the different pulleys. But the shaft ran continuous. In other words, you wanted a different speed on the machine that you were working at. You would just move the belt onto another pulley up over your head and then slap it onto the pulley on your machine. And those were DC motors, Dick. So there was, oh, and I, in fact, I think a lot of the old buildings, when AC came through, they had to put in converters. I remember, in fact, they had a show on television showing they had a rotary converter at Penn Station.